Well, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network and this edition of By the Book. A big thank you to our friends at Koren Publications, Magid Books. They are an imprint of Koren, of course. Go to korenpub.com, K-O-R-E-N-P-U-B.com for all the information about their incredible works. They've made yet another phenomenal author available to us here on this edition of By the Book, and that is Dr. Erica Brown. She's been a guest of ours before. In fact, we've even explored a part of today's topic before when we've spoken about Sefer Bamidbar and the role of leadership as it applies to, well, then and now. Dr. Erica Brown is a writer and educator who works as a scholar in residence, as the scholar in residence for the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, and consults with the Jewish Agency and other Jewish not-for-profits. Her latest books include Happier Endings, A Meditation on Life and Death from Simon & Schuster, and Leadership in the Wilderness, Authority and Anxiety in the Book of Numbers. She's also the author of the books Inspired Jewish Leadership, a National Jewish Book finalist, Spiritual Boredom, Confronting Scandal in the Narrow Places, Return, and co-author of The Case for Jewish Peoplehood. She writes a monthly column for the New York Jewish Week and the website Psychology Today and writes a weekly column for JTA on Jewish leadership. Dr. Erica Brown, welcome back to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you for having me again, Nachum. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
I greatly appreciate that. And I'll tell you, you have written on such a plethora of topics, it's unbelievable. Any thought, this is really out of left field, but I figured, you know, someone as comfortable with this format as you are, why not put you to the test? We always, and I say always, of course, in a qualifying manner this time around, we very often, traditionally, will read Sefer, or I should say start Sefer Bamidbar and read Parshas Bamidbar right before the holiday of Shavuos. That tradition is not upheld this year. We're going to go deeper into Bamidbar, both Bamidbar and Nusso, before getting to the holiday of Shavuos. Any thoughts about that come to mind?
I guess the thought really is the word Bamidbar, and it was the idea of being in the desert. And I think mostly of the Midrash that says that there are three ways you acquire Torah, because that's what we commemorate and celebrate on Shavuot, Ba'esh, Bamayim, Ubamidbar. In fire, you acquire knowledge and certainly Jewish knowledge and a depth of spirituality through passion. You acquire knowledge through immersion. And Bamidbar, sometimes you acquire wisdom only when you're on your own, when you're in solitude, when you're far from distraction, when your sense of dependence on God is deep and pervasive and surrounds you. So I suppose I think about the Sinai experience and why it had to be in a desert. Why wasn't it in Jerusalem, for example? I mean, or in the land of Israel where perhaps we'd expect it. Something tells me that we needed to be someplace very solitary, very vast, very open in order to acquire the richness of the Torah.
So it's not just the times make the man, the geography also makes the man, huh?
Very much so. In fact, I would say the whole introduction to the book talks about why we need to pay attention to landscape in terms of paying it, as we get into the psyche of what goes wrong and why so much anarchy happens in the book. It really has to do a lot with all the things that we're fighting against, that are fighting against us in the geography as we're trying to advance. I imagine that because of the warm weather, some people are gardening, and you know that every time you turn around, there's more weeds, and it requires this constant sort of diligence and vigilance to really bear fruit and for things to flower. And I think that was something that we struggled against, and our leadership suffered as a result of obstacles surrounding us that we couldn't overcome.
It's so funny how many thoughts just came to my mind tangentially as you said that, because condition, obviously, you know, people always say life's not lived in a vacuum, and circumstance obviously has a lot to do with it. But, and here's a far-flung one for you. You know, people always ask me, I always ask people, why is it that the best football players in America, the young ones, come from Florida, come from Texas, come from California, and it ends up that they're able 12 months a year to get outside and play ball. And that, you know, and that, gives everyone an opportunity to, you know, hone their skills a lot better than someone who may be in the Northeast, you know, stuck at home for 6 months at a time because of the bad weather.
Yeah, so, I actually don't even want to go back to the winter. This was a hard one.
It certainly was. And so geography or conditions, if you will, obviously play a very big role. And that solitude, the solitude that the Jewish people had, because essentially, and I know there are exceptions, but essentially the desert experience was one of loneliness. And I don't mean that they didn't have a lot of people around them individually, but in terms of other nations, in terms of other things happening, it was a pretty secluded experience, right?
Yeah, very much so. And I think it requires a lot of resilience, and it requires a lot of initial organization. You know, my central thesis, one of them in the book, is that if you look at the breakdown of the entire Book of Numbers, really the first 10 chapters are devoted to the organization of the camp, the
right.
census, the flags, the placement of the tabernacle, the placement of the tribes around it, who's going to carry it, and how it's going to be reconstructed at various encampments. And then suddenly there's a huge breakdown, and there's one threat to authority after another, which just shows you, in certain ways, you can never really be prepared for the unknown. You should try to prepare, and you should try to preempt problems, but at the end of the day, as we all know, you even said it to me before the show, you know, I never really know where I'm going.
Right.
And I think that describes, for a lot of us, the existential state of life, is that we really don't know what's around the corner, and you can plan, and you can be prepared, but you really can't be prepared for everything. You have to have contingencies.
That's why, when you, and I'm sure you find this intriguing, when you read books or articles from experts in how to deal with other people, how to, you know, on a political scale, you know, LBJ, for instance, right? A master at certain types of relationships, and you try to emulate him, you know, that this is the best way to deal with the enemy, you know, meaning the political enemy, of course. This is the best way to deal with your colleagues, you know, the ones who are friendly with you, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing's foolproof. You know, in other words, all those stories and all those experiences might help somebody who's reading about them and studying them, but you never know, even with all that experience, what's going to be thrown at you.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the reasons that although there was a tendency in leadership development to read the biographies of the greats, people really moved away from that as a sole source of leadership because, you know what, you won't be at the Battle of Waterloo or the Civil War or have to make an FDR type of decision, you know, in managing the after effects of the Depression. So in the sense that you can read and be profoundly inspired by the way other people handle things, but the context of leadership will always be unique, it'll always be particular, and therefore thinking more carefully about the skill sets that leaders need, presentation skills, strategic skills, building collaborations and alliances, and those kind of skills, which in any situation you might need, are probably ultimately more important.
Wouldn't you say, however, that everybody's got their Waterloo? That everybody, in other words, that, you know, or even better, take Sefer Bamidbar. What percentage of the leadership decisions that have to be made would you consider major? Would you consider, you know, community and nation changing?
Well, I think if a leader brings 250 other leaders to your doorstep and says we're creating a mutiny, and I reference here the text of Korach,
right.
I think the sense that your leadership is collapsing from the inside can be exceptionally painful. I think to have your closest allies, and I'm talking about Moses now, having his siblings gossip about him, and to me there's a strong correlation between the family, the internal family gossip happening, and then not many chapters later, the leadership around you, the senior leadership around you, collapsing and pushing at you, because once it happens in your family, it's not long till it's gonna travel in your community. So I think that was pretty major. That's not to mention lots of external circumstances and pressures. So for me, although I was writing about an ancient book, because I do a lot of leadership development in my teaching, and I've been traveling to a lot of federations and JCCs around the country doing leadership development for the past decade or so, I've noticed how much ancient wisdom really pushes on modern sensibilities. And I think everybody right now in Jewish organizational life in North America is really struggling with governance, with good leadership, with recruiting good professionals and retaining them, with getting good volunteers and retaining them. And these things aren't easy. Governance isn't easy. Leadership isn't easy. But we're such an organizational culture that if we don't get this right, then the vision of organizations also can't move forward in advance.
Dr. Erica Brown is with us. Then excuse this question, but if someone is trying to, you know, give lessons in or, you know, some type of advice when it comes to leadership, is it better to use Moses than Patton? Or, you know, or God forbid, should I say, that essentially they both have their positives?
Well, I think it really depends on what you're studying them for. I don't think you can study any leadership style in a vacuum, because there's always the context of what situation a person found themselves in. There are very few board meetings that run like a war room. Although you may feel under siege and embattled at times,
right.
And we tend to use a lot of military language.
Right.
You know, you're being too defensive,
right.
Or I better put on my armor, or things like that. In reality, it masks the fact that most of our situations, let's face it, Nachum, they're not that dramatic.
Right.
We like to think they're dramatic when we get really enmeshed in them, but usually they're not that dramatic. We tend to create the drama around them.
Right. Yeah, I think last time we spoke, I mentioned the camp leadership to you and how people take it very, very seriously in the scheme of things. I guess it wouldn't be the equivalent of a world war or anything like that. But to a lot of people, you know, it's serious stuff. Well, you know that, you know.
Right. It is serious.
Right.
You know, searches for leadership are serious.
Right.
Firing is serious. We've had enormous number of scandals in the Jewish community since we just spoke, Nachum, which I feel bad. I mean, I don't have to report on them. I think
right.
These are things that are well known.
Correct.
And I think that signals in some way that there's some bar of integrity that's been crossed. Ehud Olmert, we just had last week. And I think these things are extremely uncomfortable and distressing for us. And on some level, we know they're wrong, but we're also really not having the public conversation about ethics that we as a community have to have, the ethics of leadership, because that really needs to shape the generation we're raising, because unfortunately it's collapsed the generation before us in many ways, and our generations are really struggling with this now.
And the Bible has its share of unethical leaders.
Yeah. Well, if you look at it, you look at some characters who, you know, you take David, King David, for example. You know, we all sing a song about King David, and he's our most famous king of Israel, and he's the author of Psalms, and we associate him with so much beauty and so much depth, and yet at the same time, he's someone who the biblical text has no shame in condemning. He did what was wrong in the eyes of the Lord.
Right.
So, and the text shares that with us. And a lot of people have struggled with the fact that the Bible is quite as open as it is about the flaws of our leaders, because I think they're trying to give us a portal into leadership maturation. You know, there will come a time when power will have the potential to corrupt you. Overcome that. Read these stories. Learn from their mistakes before you make your own, or when you make your own.
Dr. Erica Brown, the book is Leadership in the Wilderness, Authority and Anarchy in the Book of Numbers, Magid Books Release, Koren Publications, korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Authority and Anarchy. Is there such a thing as any authoritative situation not having anarchy in it? In other words, once leadership and once the role of leadership and once a clear role of leadership has been introduced into a situation, aren't you always going to have, okay, maybe the word isn't anarchy, but aren't you going to have some dissension, some, you know, we say about Mordechai, you know, Ratzoy Lerovechov, aren't you always going to have some percentage of people or of you know, attitudes in certain people that, you know, are not with the leader?
I think you have to have them. I think it contributes to a healthy democracy. And I personally am very reassured and comforted by the fact that every page of Talmud is an engagement in debate, because I think it speaks to the fact that we take you seriously, but for the health of our nation, we're going to question authority. I think the question for me today is how we question authority. A lot of people are reduced to incivility. They say things that are harsh. They can tweet things out to the world and post their opinions. And I think that can be potentially very, very pernicious. We've seen a lot of reputations ruined as a result of it. So I think a lot of it is how you question authority, not the fact that you question it.
Could Moses have gotten through what he went through, and Korach, I guess, would be the prime example, but if there are others in Bamidbar that I should be citing, please let me know. Without divine help, in other words, is it much, much easier being a leader of a spiritual people when you have God on your side and sometimes intervening with things?
That's a good question. I mean, I think I need God every day on my side. So I'm hoping we're on the same team.
Yeah, but here he literally intervenes and punishes the enemy. Like,
yes. Yes, but at the same time, you'd think with that intimacy with God, with God's presence in the desert, made known in so many different ways, you know, cloud and pillar and voice and Sinai, you'd think that the people would always be on edge. You'd think that these incidents would not have occurred at all. And I think it just goes to show that even when you feel the divine presence is with you and guiding you, human patience is short, our material needs are huge, our hunger is deep, and our need to be at a destination is pervasive. One of the things that I've really taken so much to heart in my own research in Sefer Bamidbar is the fact that we today use a lot of language around the Jewish journey.
Right.
You know, the idea that we're all on a journey. Right. And I'm kind of tired of that language, because I think that part of the lesson from the Bible is, from our Tanakh, from our Hebrew Bible, is it's about the destination. It's where are you going to? Because if you know where you're going and that place is good, you can put up with a lot of obstructionist behavior. If you have that kind of clear vision, it's just very hard to have clear vision and singular sort of drive and ambition when you're not really sure that the destination is worthwhile. So I'd like to see a shift actually in our Jewish language today, more around destination than journey alone.
The spies that are cited in Parsha Shlach in Bamidbar are Jewish leaders, correct?
They were.
And
everyone.
Right. And they're dealt with rather harshly, as we know. And their reputation forever is one of disdain. However, there are people who argue that, you know, who at the beginning of the conversation about those meraglim, those spies, will argue, you know, they were only doing what they were told. They didn't do such a bad thing. Are they getting a bum rap? Were they in fact misusing their leadership position?
Well, it's an excellent question. I think that the Hebrew in the text is not l'ragel, to spy, it's latur, which is really to examine or investigate. Right. So I think we've actually done a disservice to the text by mistranslating the word. When you're out in the military, when you have a quartering party, they're your advance party, they go out, they look at the shetach, the territory, and they determine, is this a good place to set up camp or not? And that's really the way that they were set up. And they were given some set questions. The problem wasn't in the fact that they answered, it was that they gave an opinion based on the facts that they brought back, and no one asked them for an opinion. Because we didn't ask you, should we go or should we stay? We wanted to know about the soil quality and about the enemies and about the fruit, but you basically gave your opinion, no, we shouldn't go. And what's amazing to me about that text, and I find very inspiring, is the sense of perspective that is required of us. Well, some people say we can't go, and then Kalev stands up and says, no, you know, we can do this, and uses a double verb, an emphatic sort of sense, yuchal, we can do this. Now, when you're in a subjective situation and someone says you can't do this and someone says you can, who's right? Well, no one's right. It's really a question of perspective and whether or not you're going to put the psychic energy into accomplishing something or backing away from it. Some people will say go for it. I'll use the Sheryl Sandberg, lean into the situation,
right.
And some people will move away. And I think the problem in that text was that the fear of the risk just eclipsed everything, and that wasn't really what Moses had asked them to do. So I think if we look at it as spying, it's a whole different category of transgression.
Because then you'd expect them to give a report. Or
you
give their own opinion.
Give a report.
Right,
correct.
A report.
And also, you wouldn't, the bias here in
right.
the text is around what they do with it. In fact, one of the things that's very striking to me about that particular Torah reading of Shalach is that we conclude with the mitzvah of tzitzit.
Right.
And to me, the idea that you're wearing tzitzit and the idea is that you remember heaven and earth is saying, how do you keep perspective? Well, in Jewish tradition, we keep perspective by surrounding ourselves with reminders of
right.
who we are, what we stand for, so that we don't lose perspective when times get tough, and they do.
Excellent point. Dr. Erica Brown is with us. Do you ever address the issue of succession, because you alluded to it earlier. That's one of the problems we have. I think you alluded to it earlier. One of the problems we have in our community today is that when Jewish organizations, different types of hierarchies that have been established, you know, when it's time to move on, so to speak, that there's often a difficulty in replacing people who've been in leadership positions, right? You'd agree with that, correct? That whole system.
I don't think you could disagree with
right. that. So have you examined the transition from Moses to Joshua? It may not be specifically in the book of Numbers, but is there something we can learn about leadership from the way that transition took place?
I think that whenever you look at biblical texts, succession is built in. And Abraham cares not only about giving, about who will be his heir, but making sure that his heir is married and having children of his own.
Right.
In other words, it's not, for us, it's not so much about the Jewish children. It's about the Jewish grandchildren.
Right.
It's not about the Jewish leader who's up next. It's about the Jewish leader who's going to be here a decade from now or 100 years from now. And so when Moses is told in Numbers 20 that he will, as a result of his transgression in calling the Jews, in striking the rock and calling the Jews mordim, you're rebellious, labeling the people, when you denigrate the people you lead, I think your power to lead has been significantly diminished. And so when he does that and God says you're not going to enter the land, Moses says, will this people be like a flock without a shepherd? In other words, Moses, it didn't make the case only for himself, reinstate me, he's basically saying these people need to be led. And it's, to me, it's one of the most fascinating questions that gets addressed in the Bible and in leadership literature generally, is why would people rather be led by bad leaders than no leaders?
Yeah. And they're attracted sometimes also to bad leaders.
Yeah, attracted to Barbara Kellerman wrote a wonderful book in leadership literature called Bad Leadership, and it's all about qualities. We tend to think that leadership is a good thing, but it's for many people, leadership is callous, and some of the greatest leaders in terms, if you define leadership as someone who has followers, Stalin, Lenin, you know, Hitler, these are people who were great leaders on that, in terms of amassing followers, but in terms of their moral integrity and where they were taking people to and the methods they used to achieve their goals, we find that heinous.
Yeah, we always say good leaders with bad leadership qualities.
Right.
By the way, on the grandchildren point, I always like quoting Rabbi Riskin, who says that he stopped fearing death when he had his first grandchild. Oh, that actually works out with your other book as well. And I think that's really profound and much deeper than what I'm saying.
Stop. Yeah, I mean, look, I opened my book, Happier Endings, which is not a Jewish book, but certainly informed by Jewish tradition. I opened it with my own fear of death because I think it's hard to live in a world where you constantly deny your mortality. And I think Judaism doesn't do that. I think Jewish life has a very healthy approach to death and healthy approach to using death to leverage life. I mean, how many religions wear a necklace that says, you know, hi, right?
Right.
The idea that just simply living, the fact of our existence is important.
Why is it that the on the topic of succession again, that it seems it always goes so smoothly in the Bible? That's a
think so?
Doesn't it?
Maybe you need to read it again.
Unless I was just going to say, unless that, you know, I'm always looking at it after the fact and not really viewing it from the process, so to speak. You know what
I'm
saying?
Certainly, when you look at two biblical books that don't really get read often, which is right at the end of our 39 biblical books, the Divrei Hayamim Aleph and Bet, the Book of Chronicles 1 and 2, you see a succession of one leader after the other, and it'll often say, you know, he started off good, and then you know, he ended up as a miserable king, and then he did what was an anathema in the eyes of God, or he violated the principles by which he should have lived. It was all of these statements, and I think you see there that although you're moving from leader to leader, the transition really isn't smooth at all. Certainly, if you look at the thick of our books, Samuel and the books of Kings, you find a lot of internecine fighting. You find a lot of jockeying for the next position. You find, you know, brother against brother vying for leadership. These are old stories, universal stories of competition.
Yeah, maybe because there always is a successor, it seems more seamless. And when you're in the thick of things, wondering what the community is going to be like, you know, a couple of decades from now, it seems like it's
right.
A lot less seamless. When you alluded to Moses hitting the rock, so does that teach us that losing one's temper affects one's quality leadership? it would affect it, right? People would look.
Yeah, I think for me, the real sin of the text or the leadership transgression is, as I mentioned earlier, Moses labels the people, "You rebels." And
right.
The moment you don't respect the people you lead, you can't lead as well.
Then why is it? I'm sorry.
No, I actually just want to share an observation about Jewish communal life. I've noticed this phenomenon that a lot of senior professionals, but also senior lay leaders, will be often the least attentive at a meeting. They'll be the ones on their electronic devices.
Right.
They'll be the ones having the sidebar conversations. They don't participate in the exercise. They stand in the back of the room. In a sense, and to me, it shows deep disrespect for the people you lead. I'm above this. I can set the rules, but I don't have to pay attention to them.
Right.
And I think actually, when we have the capacity to hold up a mirror to our own behavior and leadership, we realize that maybe we're not so far off from some of the behaviors that Moses engaged in when he started to lose his leadership pull, and yet that was kind of highly articulated. He went out and said it. We don't always have to say it. Our body language says, "Do I respect you or do I not respect you?"
Right. Understood. Because on that topic, I don't know if you've ever been asked this question before, but you see leaders, especially in the world of sports, coaches, some of whom maintain their leadership and the hold over their team and the respect of their team in the most, calm demeanor possible, and others who are maniacal, temper flared coaches who yet are viewed, maybe it's only by the media, but are viewed as really effective, and it seems like they still have, hold of their team.
Well, I guess it's a question of short-term relationship versus long-term relationship. I may do what you say because I'm afraid of you, but I actually deep down hate you. In fact, it might not be that deep down. And what kind of relationship do you want to cultivate over time? I can't speak to sports because I just can't.
But I'm sure you've seen.
I could.
But I'm sure you've seen board meetings with tempers flaring.
I have, but I think we actually sometimes do the opposite, and that's not healthy. In other words, we have highly manicured meetings, and then the real tempers flare after the meeting in a slew of emails or in the parking lot conversation, and the parking lot conversation is generally near the most expensive car in the parking lot. So in terms of looking at that dissonance and saying, what happens when we don't actually put all of the heat on the table, and you'll read leadership writers like Ron Hafetz and Marty Linsky in Leadership on the Line, they say turn up the heat. And it was turn up the heat in a safe, contained space. Whenever people tell you there's a problem, dig deeper. Put the whole problem on the table. Because often what happens is that our meetings are really boring because there's just not enough conflict. And we know that there's conflict in the organization, and we know that there are deeply interesting questions to be asked and answered.
Right.
But often we have them in hushed whispers as opposed to having them up front. One of the texts I just love in Sefer Bamidbar is when Miriam and Aaron are talking against Moses, and then God comes down, singles the two of them out as if he were taking them to the principal's office, and he kind of puts them in front of the Ohel Moed, and the central meeting place, and basically says, don't speak that way. That's not the way that we dress. He's not your brother. He's Avdi, my servant. In other words, you're looking at him the wrong way. You're looking at the conversation the wrong way. So I think we need to raise the heat before we lower the heat of conversations. I hate incivility, but I think a good conflict is always good for leadership.
Interesting. And again, he comes down and chides Aaron and Miriam. And Moshe had that advantage of God coming down and taking care of it himself.
That's true. I wish we could stop all gossip.
Right. I mean, could you imagine? That's what happens when God comes down. It actually puts an end to it.
Right. It puts an end to it because I think there's a level of self-consciousness you can't get away. And I think a lot of us say things about other people because we think we can get away with it. In fact, one of the great Talmudists one of our great sages in the Talmud, says that he never said anything that he had to look both ways in order to say it. In other words, whatever he spoke, he was prepared to say in front of whomever he spoke it about,
right.
Which to me is a really high level. Often in leadership, someone will say, "Oh, shut the door, because we're going to have one of those conversations."
Right.
And here you have a Talmudic sage saying, "I never had a conversation where I had to say to anyone, 'Shut the door, I would say it to your face. And I think we're afraid to do that, so we say it behind the door.
Right. I remember a camp meeting once where someone said, if you're willing to say it to all of us, we're willing to implement it as camp policy. Meaning if it's something that, you know, everybody can accept and live with, and then I guess it's sort of the same thing. By the way, on the story with the parking lot, I'm assuming the conversation was near the wealthiest car because the wealthiest people are usually the ones involved in the post-meeting conversation.
I mean, unfortunately, I think if we're going to have an honest conversation, I think a lot of board membership, and I'm not minimizing the significance of fundraising and funders and the financial equation that keeps organizations alive, but I do think our boards have become very lopsided. There was a time when board composition was extremely important in Jewish organizational life and organizational life generally. We wanted people who had wisdom. We wanted people who had institutional memory. We wanted people who could be funders. We wanted people who had legal expertise, who had marketing expertise. Today in Jewish life, we've tended towards people who have the financial wherewithal to keep institutions afloat, and sometimes there's often a large gift that accompanies board membership. And what's happened is that we've created these lopsided boards where some of those other qualities we've lost along the way. That's a concern. That's very concerning.
That's a big frustration for people who are involved in those boards and would like to see a lot get done, and unfortunately the best leader is not in that position because, again, the person who is in that position may have, given a certain gift or however it is.
Say, you know, I can never be president here, although I have a lot of great ideas and vision, because I can't afford to be president. And we can't actually afford to lose people with creativity and a head for innovation and a clear way of articulating a vision. I think we lose good people as a result.
With all these different methods that are now in play, email and you said about social media earlier and all these different and texting where people, you know, people could be sitting in a board meeting and be texting to everybody sitting at that board meeting except the person that they're saying the comment about, you know, a derogatory comment. I mean, it's like, you know, we're at a stage now where immediacy is not even the issue. It's that you could literally break down an entire infrastructure.
Yeah, actually, there's been writing about this in the Israeli army, where a parent can connect to the commanding officer of their child's unit. I mean, and they've been in the army themselves. Maybe they're questioning a maneuver. So you can see how devastating this can be in terms of keeping leadership intact. You know, although I'm concerned when electronic devices are used in meetings, particularly, you know, kind of tweeting out maybe information that's really confidential.
Right.
You know, I think about something that's much more effective, which is body language. What happens when two powerful people in the room are rolling their eyes when someone else speaks? You think other people don't see that.
Right.
They do see that. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can undermine leadership. And I think that if you can do it overtly and transparently within a boardroom, that's wonderful. When you leave the boardroom, you are a united team. And I think there's a lot of breakdown of really very fundamental truths about the way that leadership works in the way that we work today. So it's no surprise that everyone wants a leadership development program and a young leadership, senior leadership, women's leadership, because I think we're starting to realize that we have to re-energize the way that we lead and inspire. But we can't only be about issues of governance. We have to be about what is the Jewish vision for what our organizations look like and why this synagogue exists, how this day school is different than other day schools, what contribution is unique that we're giving to the world. And I think that language of inspiration has to be coupled with some of the basic tenets of leadership.
Dr. Erica Brown is with us. We're about to start Sefer BaMidbar, everybody. It happens this week, of course. We're in the week of Sefer BaMidbar. And the book is entitled Leadership in the Wilderness, Authority and Anarchy in the Book of Numbers. Magid Books release. Koren Publications, KORENPUB.com. We call this segment By the Book. And we have an opportunity to speak with Dr. Erica Brown. Before I let you go, I got to ask you, I know that the upcoming book, what you're working on, I assume now, is the Haggadah Shel Pesach, right?
I am indeed.
And I got to ask you the question, or a variation of the question, I've asked other authors who are working on timely works, meaning something that has to do with our calendar. I remember asking Rabbi Weinrib as he was in the midst of releasing the Kinnis that he worked on. I said, what's it like having Tisha B'Av all year round. What's it like, you know, being in the midst of Kinnis all through the year? So I ask you, what's it like being at the Pesach Seder the entire year?
Right. Well, you know, I don't eat bread at my computer. I actually, the truth is, it's such a joy working on it. You know, when I worked on a book on death and I worked on a book on scandal, and those were actually really painful books to write. So every day when you submerge yourself in the writing of it, but, you know, you're deeply encountering it and reliving it on some level and developing it and digging deeper in it, it can be hard. And sometimes you need to take a break from it for a while, you know, when it's in an editing stage, or you just need to pause because it's so heavy. I actually feel that when I started the project, it had a feeling of euphoria for me. I mean, I love Passover. I think the messages of redemption and possibility are remarkable, and the text is very familiar, and, you know, the biblical themes. I'm doing it similar to some of my other books, which is, there's a commentary on the Haggadah, but at the end there are going to be 8 essays and an epilogue, one for each day of Passover, because I think after the Seder or the Starim, Passover gets a bit of a short shrift, so trying to kind of write an essay, a Tanakh-based essay for each day to sanctify each day and make it special. So it's just been this really beautiful immersion in something that I love.
When did the immersion begin? How many months ago?
I've actually been writing this book for years.
So I can't even ask if it changed this past Pesach. If anything, it's already had an effect on you for years, not just...
In other words, I've been teaching Exodus for many, many years. I've been writing on this probably for 5 or 6 years, different pieces of this. I did start the commentary relatively recently. It was the essays I was working on. And one thing I because of course every author has to, on a traditional text has to ask, who needs you?
Right.
And I think I still keep asking myself that question, why am I doing this? But I'm trying to personalize it. In other words, after the commentary, I'm trying to really ask a question to help the reader integrate the experience with their own experience of the holiday. So I really have pulled away from the kind of dense scholarly commentary, which removes you from the emotional joy that you're supposed to experience.
Interesting.
And you know, the idea that you're supposed to have 4 cups of wine. Well, if you're really having those 4 cups of wine, I don't know what you're reading. It's hard to really get that intellectual experience. So I'm trying to make it a much more spiritual, emotional experience through the commentary, and we'll see if I can achieve that. I hope so.
You know, I complained to Rabbi Sachs before Pesach that I don't like that every Tom, Dick, and Harry has a Haggadah. I don't like that happened in our tradition. Scholars like yourselves, you know, they deserve to have their Haggadah mass produced for the audience. But I didn't like the fact that everybody is out there.
Yeah, and I did struggle with that question. But I think part of the joy, at least for me as an author, I can't say for a reader, is really to feel connected to a text that people have commented on for such a long time, and you just feel that you've jumped into this remarkable conversation, this profound conversation over the ages. Because redemption does take on a lot of different faces in the Jewish community. And honestly, the trend in the Orthodox community has to be, you know, is to write a lot of scholarly commentary. But in the non-Orthodox community right now, the trend is to bring a laptop to the Seder.
Right.
And so I guess for me, trying to say, and I actually was interviewed for a newspaper article about bringing devices to the Seder. And I said, you know, could you imagine? So, you know, everyone who brings a device to the Seder and they say, I have this wonderful commentary, but hold on, let me also check my emails. I think it's just hard because of the multiplicity of connections that any device can make to not be distracted by it. So I really was trying for that audience as well, for an audience that might not be as traditional and not really find themselves in a Haggadah that they like.
Wow, fascinating, unbelievable. I hope I have the opportunity to speak with you about it before next Pesach.
Yes, let's.
Unbelievable, I'll tell you. You're just incredible. Dr. Erica Brown, the book you want now for the book of Bamidbar, for Sefer Bamidbar, is Leadership in the Wilderness, Authority and Anarchy in the Book of Numbers. I've had the privilege now more than once to examine this work with Dr. Erica Brown. It's an amazing book, and you'll be able to go to her website, ericabrown.com, and check out all the different books she's written. really an amazing collection. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Well, thank you, Nachum. It's been really a pleasure. Thank you, and I hope you have a wonderful week, and enjoy the Book of Bamidbar. I did.
I'm glad to hear you did. I can tell you as a reader that I certainly am. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Dr. Erica Brown, unbelievable. I'll tell you, she's incredible. Buy the book. Our friends at Curran Publications bring you this segment in its first run every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And I thank them for giving me the privilege to bring you incredible authors on a regular basis. Really amazing. And Dr. Erica Brown, no exception to that. Simply incredible. All the information you need about Magid Books and Curran Publications is on the site, korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Utilize that website to the fullest. You will benefit from that greatly, trust me. This edition of Buy the Book, an exclusive presentation of the Nachum Segal Network.